So our first talk is Loreen Lynn from Red Mountain Consulting and talking about Arctic tundra disturbance.
Well, thank you, Jay. So I'm going to preface my talk just to start off with that I am a consulting soil scientist, and generally speaking, clients are disinclined to pay me to do any kind of research, especially when the price of oil is as low as it's been for as long as it's been. So what I do is applied science. It is not research-based, so I'm just going to preface my talk that way. And I wanted to also say that my collaborator, Dr. David Weindorf, although he obviously is a researcher, and the reason why he is my collaborator on this is that he is one of my main go-to resources when it comes to asking questions or looking for people to talk to or situations like that. The University of Alaska Fairbanks, unfortunately, is shrinking their soils program to almost nothing, and it's nice to have people in academia or in the public sector I can call on to ask questions when I need to get help with something. So I just wanted to start with this photograph as a photo I took flying over the oil fields this summer, just to give you an idea of what the Prudhoe Bay oil fields look like to some degree. And this is an active exploration pad right here, and you can see that it's definitely in wetlands. So everything up on the North Slope is classified as a wetland, generally speaking. There are a few select uplands on the North Slope, but most of it is wetland and it is very, very wet. And so the older exploratory well pads where they went out and they looked for oil and didn't find something, pulled out, they'll plug and abandon the well. And some of the older drilling methods were to take the drilling muds and cuttings and they'd spit them into a pit that they had dug next to the wellhead. And some of that stuff was buried in place, some of it was removed, and then clean gravel was put back in the pit, and then it was covered with organic soils in order to for runoff to run off of the pit, and you don't end up with seeping pollutants out of these old reserve pits. Now that you can see in this pad, you see the line of boxes running down the middle, the small ones. Those are all wellheads, and the ponds on either side of it are the current reserve pits, and they're no longer putting drilling cuttings and mud into those pits, but those pits there are to catch if there were ever any spills because they are not connected hydrologically to the surrounding waters. So generally speaking, when we want to restore these sites, we don't use the word restoration because there's such a short growing season on the North Slope, and we cannot get the sites back to the condition that they were prior to any disturbance in a human lifespan. So we use the word rehabilitation instead. And the goals are to basically produce a productive plant environment that can also support some species of wildlife. So I just wanted to just pull up kind of the parallels between soil quality and wetland functions, because both play a part in our goals and how we do our rehabilitation on these sites. And so there are a lot of parallels between the two bodies of thought and the ways of looking at soil quality and wetland function. And each of these are to some degree addressed, although not directly, in the tundra rehabilitation that we do. So we are working on soil, on water quality and nutrient cycling and that sort of thing. And of course, carbon sequestration is a hot topic in the Arctic because there is so much carbon stored in the soils up there. So it's interesting that in a wetland function aspect this is a wetland function methodology that's applied to the North Slope. It's a carbon export. It's considered a wetland function, although in tundra soils, of course, in the permafrost, you're freezing a lot of the carbon, and so it actually doesn't go anywhere. It stays put. In the rehabilitated sites, when you build one of these pads, generally speaking, they'll lay down, occasionally they'll lay down insulative foam board, but sometimes it's just gravel. And the weight of the gravel and the equipment that's on it will compress the vegetation that's underneath, and it will eventually decompose. And so once the gravel's removed, there's virtually no carbon left in the near surface soils on those sites. So I just wanted to quickly just run through the limitations. Some of you guys have know this stuff already, but Prudhoe Bay oil field, and then there's all the adjacent oil fields as well. So there's Kuparuk and Alpine and all the other companies, ConocoPhillips and Exxon, and so many, many small companies that are now doing oil exploration in the Arctic and Alaska. But this is the location of Prudhoe Bay. I want you to also take note to the northwest, there's the town of Barrow, which they have self-elected to change their name to a Inupiaq name, which is Utqiagvik, which I cannot say exactly, but that's as close as I can get. And just because the climate data I have is from Utqiagvik and not from Prudhoe Bay, but it's just very far north. And so if you look at the average high and the average low temperatures and what is the growing season there, which generally we cannot start our work until late July. That's when the vegetation is in full growth. And then by the end of August, it's snowing. So that is the window. We have 5 weeks to get this work done. So it's rather cold there. The highs are oftentimes 35-40, lows are 35-40, basically. This is a picture out of Utqiagvik of the Arctic Ocean, showing that at July 1st, it's still covered in sea ice. When the wind blows off the ocean, it's very cold. Those cold winds, of course, affect the growth of the vegetation. So it's very slow, it's very small, it's very short. Everything's very short from the wind. And you can see the guy out there, he's actually standing on the ice, he's seal hunting. So on these pads, I just wanted to also, some of the problems that we run into these salt crusts. So you can see the white crust, and we've done some lab analysis on it. It's usually calcium carbonate crust, and it emerges and rises to the surface. So in a lot of situations, of course, when you have a salt crust, you do leaching. But you can't do leaching in permafrost soils because it's frozen underneath. So there's nowhere for the water to go. So instead, one of the things we've tried doing is tilling, just to give the plants a head start and some fresh soil to get started in. I'll show you some pictures of that in a bit. I also took this picture because I was startled to see a bumblebee in the Arctic. I had never seen one there before. And there was some Twitter scientist who was gathering pictures, and so I took that. So this was one site where we had a pretty bad salt crust. It was a very hard surface soil. And so we had this, well, it's a four-wheeler with a harrow of sorts that was manufactured by a guy up there on the slope with a pallet lying on top. We had some logs just to see, to give it some weight. That's as fancy as the equipment gets up there when it comes to anything to do with, like, cultivation equipment. And this site, of course, is on the road system. So the sites that are off the road system that you access by helicopter, they have flown a four-wheeler out to those sites before, but with oil prices these days, they won't even consider that sort of thing. In the second picture on the upper right, that's a picture of us scrambling around. There's these little saxifrage plants growing on the site before we tilled it, and so we ran around after the tiller and replanted them, just like if every plant counts there. In another site, we didn't have access to the four-wheeler, so we just raked meter-by-meter square plots. We also didn't have very much seed because all the seed that we use up there has to be collected up there. And there's nobody cultivating forb seed from the Arctic. And so we have to collect it by hand, and it's a very intensive process. And so we're very careful about how we use the seed to make sure it's successful. So here's a site that I visited this year after 10 years after the removal of gravel. And this is actually an access road. So you can see it's a strip of land. In the far corners of the slide, you can see the undisturbed tundra, and right down the center is the access road. On many of these sites, because it's underlain by permafrost, once you remove the gravel and you get this, you have this bare soil surface, you have a lower albedo, and so the heat penetrates, and it'll actually melt the ice that's in the ice wedges in the polygonal trough, in the polygonal ground. And so those troughs will end up filling with water, which, of course, because of how the heat capacity of water can end up propagating that thaw into the surrounding tundra. And this is something that's difficult to control for. It's difficult to predict how much ice is under the ground without actually drilling everywhere. And I'll show you in the next picture. This is an aerial view of the same access road. So the access road is running from left to lower left to upper right, and you can see there's some very wet spots on it, there's some drier spots on it. So in order to predict the ice, you'd have to drill all along that road, which is just, it's too much work, especially in a site like this that you have to access by helicopter. So after 10 years of recovery, you can also see moving off towards the left is the old gravel pad and reserve pit. The reserve pit, if you can notice, let's see, we have a mouse, right, that we can point with? So the reserve pit is this lighter green area, and the reason it's a different color is because it was planted with native grass cultivars. So grass seed was collected on the North Slope, taken to Palmer, Alaska, at the plant material center, bred there, and then we were planting it there. And, of course, tundra is not grass. It's generally sedge plants. It's sedge-based vegetation. And so the grass shows as this bright, bright green, especially after it's been fertilized. So, and it's also a slightly higher elevation because it's a capped pit. So this is another site we visited, and this is an old, it was a very, very long access road. This is a very old site. They don't generally build this long of access roads any longer. It seems to me that when they removed the gravel from the site, they didn't remove enough. And so after 10 years, it's barely recovered. I mean, our goal is that in 10 years, we have 10% cover of vascular vegetation, and this site is falling far below that. And then we're left with the logistics of removing gravel means going in the winter, building an ice road to bring in heavy equipment. And construction guys with heavy equipment are out there, and nobody like me, no scientists are out there to manage the scene, so you have to rely on them to just follow a plan that you've written, and we all know that plans are only as good as they are, right? So we can't, generally speaking, go back out to a site and revisit it. And this is that same access road from the air. You can see how much it stands out on the landscape. Then we've got the opposite issue. Here, too much gravel was removed, and so the whole site fell out, it subsided, and the whole thing is now a square lake other than the reserve pit. So it's this difficulty of predicting the ground ice quantity and how much gravel needs to be removed. I've proposed to them that we do a study using mostly GIS remote sensing to distinguish the various features, because you can see, let me get this mouse going again, there's a border boundary right here. It's an old thaw lake basin. And so right in here, this whole area is an old lake basin. And so you know that if you're laying gravel there, you're going to have different ice content than you do if you lay it out in higher polygonal ground. So some of the ongoing influences, of course, oil exploration is still expanding on the North Slope, and it's expanding rapidly to the west. Currently, our legislators are trying to pass a bill in the current budget that's going to allow them to open up wildlife refuges to oil drilling with an easy 50-vote majority. It's a terrible, unhappy thing. I just wanted to show also in this picture, this is one of the original tundra roads where they take two bulldozers and run along and pile tundra up in the middle of the drive on it. That was one of the first attempts on how to build a road up there. It didn't work. So this is a reserve pit they actually drained in the hope of recovering it while it was still in production, which I wrote a recommendation to them to not do that in the future. And then, of course, there's a lot of road dust that happens, tons and tons of road dust. They're running water trucks all the time, but this is in the winter, and you can see even in the winter it's a lot of road dust. And that also will melt the snow sooner, and so you get geese on the edges of the road early. And then this site we went and visited, and the day before, you can see how all the sedge and grasses are matted down. That's because 40,000 caribou walked through the site the day before that we went to monitor it. So that was an influence we had to deal with. And then the geese also love our sites and eat the high-nutrient sedges because we fertilize. So they love it. So just to hit on this really quickly, so we are helping maintain some sort of wildlife habitat by regrowing plants on these sites. We do maintain the water quality, although we change the hydrology with shifts in elevation. When it comes to nutrient cycling, we are adding fertilizer, which is something that has never been studied and another research project begging for somebody to do. And we, although if you compare the original site biomass to what it is in reclamation, it's not even close to the same amount, but maybe in 100 years it will be. And I've already mentioned the habitat, and I already talked about the carbon. So one thing that I would love to have money for and a researcher to do it on, I thought about it as a PhD project, but it would take probably 20 years to study it, is how is moss development affecting soil quality? Because all the orange in this picture is moss coverage. And you'll get places like this where you have moss and liverworts growing thickly, and this does not qualify as cover, although we know that it's probably helping soil quality, but nobody's ever quantified the benefits. Everything orange and yellow, and here is moss. It's pretty prominent growth. You can see it again, and the understory here is all moss. So, and I think I'm almost out of time, but if anyone has any questions. Well, in some of the original goals of the rehabilitation to get vegetation cover was because people were worried about wind erosion. And it came to pass that after people observed it for a while, they realized that the wind really wasn't picking up the soil and moving it. And so when the standards were originally set, we were thinking grass, cover it quickly, cover it thoroughly. And we've backed off on how much grass we plant, and nobody's just revisited the standards and been able to give the agency's evidence that moss is a beneficial cover type.
All right, thanks very much.
All right, thank you.